ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 is go, the first human mission to the moon in more than 50 years. And we are following every step of the journey, from lunar flyby to splashdown, in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Join me, Belinda Smith, for mission updates so you know what's happening and why it matters. It's Artemis Explained. Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Humans have done experiments on animals for thousands of years to study their anatomy and figure out how they work, and eventually to try and improve human lives by testing medicines and other treatments. But for as long as that's been happening, there's also been concern and controversy about animal suffering and welfare, questions about whether it's right to use animals this way, and there have been considerable efforts to find alternatives. So how is this quest going? What's on the horizon? And will we ever get rid of lab animals completely? This is Lab Notes from ABC Radio National. I'm Jonathan Webb, and today I'm joined by Dr. Darren Saunders, who is the Deputy Chief Scientist and Engineer of New South Wales and also a former cancer biologist. Hi, Darren.
G'day, Jonathan.
Can you give us a sense of how long animals have played a role in scientific research and some of the progress we've made that we wouldn't have otherwise?
I would say it goes back for as long as people have been interested in how bodies work. So not just human bodies, obviously. I mean, there's parts of sea urchins that are named after Aristotle, for example. So he was looking at that sort of stuff a long way back. Look, I can't think of any piece of understanding of the way we work or the natural world around us works without some form of animal research being part of that. And that's not just anatomy and physiology, that's behavioural, that's neuroscience, that's the way animals as groups work in ecosystems. It's a broad-ranging topic.
And when you work in science, as you have and as I have as well, I'm pretty sure we both have a few mice at least on our conscience.
Many in my case.
It's kind of routine when you work in that area, but to others it might seem archaic that we're still going through quite a lot of animals in research. Where are we at with the numbers? How many are we using, say, in Australia at the moment?
The last numbers I could find, and these are reported to the state agriculture departments, that's the way the legislation works, is about 900,000 animals roughly a year ago were used, and that's mice, rats, guinea pigs, rabbits and primates, so vertebrates. We don't tend to count things that are further back in the evolutionary chain, so to speak, in those numbers, and there is some controversy around whether we should be counting those kind of animals, in fact.
So fish and flies are not on the list?
Yeah, things that aren't that don't have a sort of vertebrate kind of nervous system like us, basically.
And I'm guessing the vast majority of those are mice, would you say?
The overwhelming majority of those are mice, quite a few rats as well, and fewer guinea pigs, rabbits and primates. Yep. Very few primates, in fact.
So 900,000 in Australia last year. Is that number going up or down at the moment?
I would assume that number has gone up historically relatively recently because there is a huge reliance on animal models. But I would say with the way the funding situation is going at the moment, that number is probably dropping as we speak because there is less money going into doing that sort of research.
Because of some desire to avoid animal research, or is it just that there's less investment in research?
It's both. In fact, there is some specific funding going towards looking at alternatives to animal research, and that's appropriate. But there's also just a general lack of funding for research, and animals are very expensive experimental models, and so they're some of the first things to get cut from research programs.
If we can find alternatives, then that would be a good outcome.
I think it's really important for people to understand. You said animal research is routine, and I'm sure you had the same view. It never feels routine when you're doing it. There is a deep ethical, sort of moral, complex relationship you have with the animals you work on. I found it incredibly challenging. I still do. I haven't touched an animal in research for over a decade. I still find it a very challenging aspect of the work that I've done over the years. I think it helps to understand the reason we use animals is because, you know, mammalian bodies particularly are really complex dynamic systems. There are lots of moving parts. They interact in ways that we still don't fully understand, and therefore we can't model them computationally always. But there is a lot of work going on to, if you like, put filters upstream of when you take research into an animal. And you might do animal experiments for lots of different reasons. I think most people probably think, are you doing testing of new drugs? And that is no doubt an important part of why we do animal experiments. But we do a lot of work to understand the basic mechanisms of disease. You know, how does cancer work? How do the various diseases that affect the neural system work?
What are some of the alternatives that we're starting to see come to the fore?
Some of the things we're starting to understand now, we can take the sort of experiments we might have done in an animal and do them in a lab in cells. So we can make complex mixtures of cells, things called organoids or organs on a chip, various ways of making complex organs. And I used to work for a long time on mammary gland biology. I was working on breast cancer. So you need to understand the basic biology of a mammary gland and how it works and how those cells in a mammary gland work. And you can now model that pretty effectively, not perfectly, but pretty effectively in a dish. And so that means you use way fewer animals in that kind of research. And if you're thinking about, let's say we've come up with a new treatment for cancer, we want to think about how that is going to play out down the track. We want to do preclinical testing. You can test those kind of things in these cell models before you have to go into animals, and that greatly reduces the number of animals you use.
So it reduces the number that you're going to need because a lot of the earlier work gets done on, you know, a mammary gland in a dish, or other people are trying to work on brain mimicking organoids in
kidneys,
all sorts of
complex organs. And then if you take that even further up the chain, a lot of the work that is done in drug testing, for example, is done in toxicology. So you don't want a human to be necessarily the first living thing that has a new drug put into it, right? I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that. And so one of the things we do with animals is to test potential adverse effects of new drugs. Now, because we've been doing that for some time, we've actually started to build up quite a good understanding of the things that help us predict toxic effects of drugs. We can now start to model those things using AI models, for example. So there's a lot of work going on in building these giant AI databases that suck in all of the information we've known over decades about what causes toxic side effects of drugs or whether or not certain drugs will affect certain systems. And you can, you know, punch that information out of an AI model, and that might tell you, don't even bother testing this in an animal. It's going to be toxic. We know that it's going to interact with this particular system in the body. So there's lots of different ways of thinking about it. And ideally, what we want to get to is a computational model. You know, a model where we can just stick things into a computer and ask it to predict what's going to happen. Now, we're a long way from that yet. We're still not able to model a single cell at the computational level. Although only just, in fact, we've just got the minimal cell computational model.
But it's already narrowing down the number of things you might want to test in cells and then eventually in animals.
That's right, exactly. And also changing the way we do the experiments. For example, instead of growing, you know, 100 mice that all have the same tumor because we give them a particular genetic mutation, what we're getting better at now is taking tumors from humans and building biobanks in animals that better reflect the diversity in a human population, which means in the long run, you have to test a lot fewer animals to understand better how that might play out in a broader human population. So there's lots of different ways to think about this problem.
Can you explain those biobanks a bit more?
Yeah, these things are quite amazing. So, you know, for example, in pancreatic cancer, which is one of the diseases I used to work on, a patient will have surgery to remove the tumor. A little chunk of that tumor will be taken straight across into the animal labs and actually injected into an animal as a tumor. And it grows, and there's a library of these animals, probably there'd be thousands of them now, of human tumors growing in animals. And it's kind of like a library.
Right.
And scientists can then go and sort of look at that library, test new ideas for genetics or drug treatments, and have a much better understanding of how they're going to work in a human population, which is diverse and broad, and every tumor is different, essentially.
Are there any other surprising substitutes for lab animals? I read a study a little while ago about using wax moths.
And insects are one of the workhorses of genetics and of understanding biology more broadly. And in this case, yeah, the wax moth Galeria, which is actually going on in Sydney up at Macquarie University. They have a huge colony of these things. They are really interesting because, A, it's thought to be more ethical because they're a lower animal in the evolutionary tree, so to speak. They're very cost effective and it's very fast to do experiments in them. But they have an innate immune system, that basic immune system that fights infections, that's very similar to mammals. And so you can actually do a lot of work on understanding how bacterial and fungal infections work using these animals rather than having to go to a big, complex, expensive animal model like a mouse or a rat.
Are there any other avenues that you think are surprising that people might not have heard about in terms of refining, replacing, and reducing the number of animals that we use?
I think some of the work that's done using animals is training surgeons. And so we're getting better at having simulations, for example, AI-based or computer-based virtual reality type simulations for training surgeons in surgical techniques. And I think really the one that is going to come into increasing use is the computational models. You can see the avalanche coming of people now starting to build those models, starting to apply them. And I think there's a huge future in those models. And I think it's worth pointing out that all the information going into building those models is based on all of the animal research we've done up to date. So there's a nice rounding out of the story there that all that information we've gathered over the years from all those thousands and millions of animals will eventually end up replacing animals in research because we'll have good computational models. But that's a fair way away, I have to say.
Dr. Darren Saunders, thank you for sharing your lab notes with me.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Dr. Darren Saunders is the Deputy Chief Scientist and Engineer for New South Wales. This episode of Lab Notes was produced on Gadigal and Menang Noongar country. Fiona Pepper is the producer. I'm Jonathan Webb, and I'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.